Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Peter Bull. Peter Bull is the Associate Director of the UCSD PACE program. He is not a physician. However, he knows just about as much as about physician assessment as anyone in the world. He has been doing this for just about as long as anyone has been doing it. And he's going to give us just some information on some demographics with regards to physician and age. So, Peter, you come on up.
Well, thank you, Dave, for the introduction. Thank you again, everybody, for coming here. It's great to see such a large audience. I'm going to have to try to keep this brief, so I will just hit the ground running. But basically, the point of my presentation is to just give everybody an overview of aging statistics for physicians in the United States and to just kind of set the stage for everyone else's talks. So most of the data that I'm going to be talking about came from the AMA Physician Master File. They have data about physicians, a number of different areas. I'm only going to focus on a few of those. But the way that they survey physicians is they survey about a third of all physicians every 3 years, and they ask them to fill out the survey. And one of the key areas that they ask about that I'm going to be talking about is something called major professional activity. And they classify that into two areas. One is patient care, and that could be office-based, could be hospital-based. And then the other is other professional activity, which is essentially non-patient care. And those are split into administration, teaching, research, and other. For the purpose of this talk, I'm mostly going to be talking about those who are in active practice. And one other part about the AMA data is that they consider physicians who are semi-retired or, in essence, working less than 20 hours per week as inactive. Some of the limitations of the Physician Master File data is that it's self-designated, and there's a lag time that exists between collecting the data and getting that information about physicians and where they currently are. So this first chart here I want to show you just lists all the different major professional activities. And in bold, you will see those that are the active ones, and the total number is about 697,000. And you can see the mean ages for each, and you can see the percent of the total physician population that's represented. I think one of the other things that's interesting about the AMA data, and why it's important to know this, is that with the physicians in administration or residents or locum tenens, these people may all be in some form of active practice, but they're just listed as being under 20 hours per week. So as we go forward, it's important to keep in mind that they just, for the purposes of deciding what's active practice, it doesn't necessarily capture all physicians. Looking towards the past, 1985, the number of physicians just over about 475,000. I wasn't able to ascertain the mean age at that time, but the percent of physicians who were 65 or older was around 9.4%. You fast forward 20 years, and that jumps to about 11% or 78,000 physicians who are over the age of 65. And then the most current year available, 2011, so 697,000. The mean age has now gone up another 2.5 years since 2005. And the number that are projected to be over 65 is about 105,000. So you can see it's really made a large jump, especially just in these last 6 years. And this chart I'm not going to go over in great detail, but this really can just be a reference to people, but essentially gives all the different age groups, the number of physicians, and the percent of the total in the population for those three time periods. And you can see it. The this graph actually does a better job, I think, of illustrating the three different time periods, 85, 2005, and 2010. And you can see in 1985, which is in the kind of white bar there, that the ages were really shifted towards the front end. The under 45 was a major proportion of the total physician, active physician population. But then in 2005 and especially 2010. You can see how that's now shifted to physicians who are over 45, and especially it's grown tremendously in the 55 and 65, 55 to 64 and 65 and older crowd. It is important to point out that while the AMA is seen as the authority on physician statistics and data, they're not the only ones who collect information. The U.S. Census does do this as well, and they've actually teamed up with the Bureau of Labor to get some different projections because they had some questions about some of the data that the AMA was projecting, particularly with the number of physicians who would be retiring in the future. And they thought that the estimates that were provided by the AMA showed more physicians were going to be practicing at a later age than their survey. And I'm not going to go into the details of their survey, but it's essentially extrapolated from a monthly survey of other professionals, and they use that data to try to compare it to actually the AMAs. And you'll see here what they've done is they've compared and the black dots, you have the master file data, and you can see at the 65 and older group that the AMA is projecting, and that's the kind of bottom right corner there, the AMA is projecting more physicians than this the CPS, which is the current population survey data. And the other noteworthy point is that the CPS also shows more physicians at the under 35. So they're projecting that there's more younger physicians coming aboard and there are less going to be working at older age. So this is still, I guess, a point of contention. But one of the things we can talk about is what the various estimates look like to give you a sense of kind of what the high end would be and the low end in terms of projecting what physicians, the physician workforce might look like in the next decade. So CPS estimates that, the over physicians over 55 will represent about 29% of the physician population. That's actually pretty similar to what it is right now in terms of percentages. The AMA, on the other hand, is estimating 39%, or a total of 409,000, which is actually significantly higher than what it currently is now. And so, we can take from this what we want, but to me, there's the high end, there's the low end, but given the state of the economy, the fact that people are living longer, you name it, you've got a number of different factors that are going to, I think, make people in general want to work longer, and physicians in general work longer than average Americans. So it's going to be tough to say, but the here's just the illustration of how the fact that Americans are aging too. In 2010, 13% of Americans were over 65. The projection is that by 2020, 16.1% of Americans will be over 65. And in this graph, it shows that from 2005 to 2020, the number of Americans, the percentage of Americans, who are over 65 will grow 50%. And in that same time frame, the number of the percentage of Americans who are under 65 is growing less than 10%. It really gives you an illustration of how top-heavy the country's becoming. So what's the bottom line? Well, the physician workforce is aging. So is the American population. The physician population has aged significantly from 1985 to 2011. It's a little bit up in the air how it's going to age for the future, for the next decade. You can take one end or you can take the other, but I have a feeling that it's probably going to be closer to the AMA projections, and so I think that's about it. All right. Well, thank you very much.
So what we're trying to do here is set up the premises. You see that we have an aging physician population. You see that we have an aging national population. Apologies, we did not have all of the Canadian data to present to you, but I think the percentages were going to be relatively similar, if I'm not mistaken. We're gonna need more physicians, because I think one of the points that Peter had made that maybe I'd like to highlight is that we're looking at physician shortages into the future, because as folks age, their need for healthcare absolutely increases. And so we're going to be needing more physicians around to take care of folks, and especially here in the States as we're moving towards a new type of way to deliver health care with the Affordable Care Act, all of the major indicators point to the fact that we just don't have enough doctors at this point. So the folks that are already in practice, it makes sense that they're going to be sticking around a little longer as well. We're very happy to have Dr. Dilip Jesty here. Dr. Jesty is the Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Neurosciences. He is the Chief of the Geriatric Psychiatry Division at the UCSD School of Medicine. And Dr. Jesty is actually an expert, international, or actually international, expert on aging and its effect on people. He is extremely widely published on this, and we felt we were very lucky to have one of the world's experts on aging right here in our backyard, so he kindly accepted our offer to speak. But he's going to talk about healthful aging, what to expect. Dr. Jesty.
Good morning. Thank you, David, for the kind introduction. I think today you'll be hearing mostly the things that are bad about aging, how we go down with aging. I'll be presenting a somewhat different picture, that aging can be good. I'm going to start with what I call the paradox of aging. So here, when we talk about aging, it is really not a single thing. There is physical aging, there is cognitive aging, there is psychosocial aging, and they go in different directions. Then I will talk about a few studies on aging physicians. The number of studies is small, but I will briefly review those. Then comes the most interesting part, the wisdom and what is called the neuroplasticity of aging. And finally, some examples of successful aging among physicians. Let me first ask you, how many of you are physicians? Okay, I guess about half of you. Thank you. Okay, so the first question is, what is healthful aging or what is successful aging? So a few years ago, we started wrestling with the question, and the first thing we did was to do a literature review. We found there were 28 studies that had successful aging or its synonym in its title. And between those 28 studies, there were 29 different definitions of successful aging. So there is clearly no consensus on what is successful aging. However, you'll see that 24 out of these studies use physical aging as the main criterion for successful aging. So the criterion is absence of physical disease and absence of physical disability. So what is the usual notion about physical successful aging, that woman like this, 89-year-old woman who went skydiving for the first time, or this 94-year-old man who ran a marathon? I can't even run half a marathon. Maybe I will wait till I'm 94 and then start running a marathon. By the way, this person just turned 100, and he ran another marathon. So that's the usual notion that people have about successful aging, that we will live up to the age of 90, 100, and we'll be running marathon, mountain climbing, and so on. Unfortunately, that definition will exclude most of us, because most of us won't be so lucky to have no physical illness and no physical disability. With aging, most of us will have arthritis, hypertension, diabetes. Some will have heart disease, stroke, cancer. Does that mean that most of us are aging unsuccessfully? Also, that means that somebody like FDR, who was in a wheelchair most of his lifetime, most of his adult life, after he developed Guillain-Barré syndrome at the age of around 34, he would be an unsuccessful ager. Even a more striking example, Stephen Hawking, the British physicist, who has Lou Gehrig's disease, which paralyzes most muscles in the body. Thanks to the new computer technology, even very subtle movements of his eyelids or lips can now translate into words. And so he gives course-on-course lectures and writes books. And he's really one of the major thinkers of our time, in spite of being so physically disabled. So what is successful aging then? So with that in mind, we started studies here at UCSD, Stein Institute for Research on Aging. And we have studied more than 4,000 community dwelling non-institutionalized people between 50 and 100 years of age. We excluded people in nursing homes because they wouldn't be able to participate in the study. But other than that, we really didn't have any inclusion-exclusion criteria. So, in other words, the people we included are not marathon runners, mountain climbers, or skydivers. They are the usual people, middle-aged and older people that you and I see. Among other things, we did a detailed survey questionnaire, and that include a bunch of questions. It takes about an hour and a half to complete. It has scales about health, physical, mental, health behaviors, medical history, and so on. It also has skills about optimism, resilience, wisdom. And then we ask one simple question. Where do you rate yourself on successful aging on a scale from 1 to 10? 1 is the worst, 10 is the best. We didn't tell people how to rate yourself. We didn't tell them the definition. We said, use your own definition, but just tell us where you think you rank on that scale from 1 to 10. We also did telephone interviews about 1,300 people. If we had used a physical criteria, namely no physical disease, no physical disability, fewer than 20% of these folks would have met those criteria. So most of these people are not aging successfully according to the physical criteria. An average person in this study would be a woman in her 70s who lost her husband a few years ago. She has arthritis, hypertension, diabetes. She had MI a few years ago, living by herself, doing okay, not great. So what would such a woman give on a 1 to 10 scale? Again, 1 is the worst, 10 is the best. We thought most people would give themselves 3, 4, maybe at the most 5. One thing we found that, as you would expect, that there was a slight decline in cognition over this period, which is to be expected. And I will talk about that, and Dr. Perry will talk about that in detail later. We also use a rating scale called SF-36. It's the most commonly used rating scale for health-related functioning and quality of life. And it has two components, physical and mental. The physical component seems to go down with age, as you would expect. So, interestingly, the mental health component does not go down. As a matter of fact, there is a slight increase. The most interesting is this, though. I told you about the self-rated successful aging on a 1 to 10 scale. We thought most people would give themselves 3, 4, or 5. Most people gave themselves 7, 8, 9, or even 10. The mean rating was 8.4. So there was something going on there that these people were aging physically. Some of their cognitive abilities were going down, and yet they felt that they were doing well. This is really the best example of what I call paradox of aging. The broken green line shows the percent of people who have no disability. And as you see, that the percentage is about 60% in the 50s and then goes down to less than 10% in the 90s. Again, that's what you would expect. But paradoxically, the self-rated successful aging goes in the opposite direction. Now, one would argue that maybe all of these subjects were delusional or demented or bipolar. They didn't know what they were doing, and they just felt great. So we looked at other non-physical criteria for successful aging. Independent living, positive adaptation, engagement with life, sense of mastery, growth, life satisfaction, even overall cognitive function. And most of these people met most of those non-physical criteria. So it looked like if we can call this psychosocial aging, that seems to go in different direction than physical aging. So the significant associations, who were the people who were doing better in these areas? The predictors were three: attitudes, health, and activities. In terms of attitude, it was positive attitude toward aging, optimism, resilience, sense of self-efficacy, low level of perceived stress. I highlighted the word perceived because everybody had stress, obviously physical, psychosocial, financial, and others. But the extent to which people felt the stress, the extent to which they were overwhelmed with stress, differed. Health, very important predictor was the level of depressive symptoms. And I'm not talking about depression as a diagnosis. Even two symptoms of depression were worse than one symptom. One was worse than zero. And very important were activities of different time, physical activities, exercise at any level. People in wheelchairs can throw beach ball to one another, and that is physical activity. We are surprised at how many older people were using computers. Mostly they use computers to exchange pictures of their grandkids. But still, socialization with friends. Now, when I present this data, usually people say, oh, these are data from San Diego. And in California, everybody smokes pot and everybody feels high. And so we can't really, they are not generalizable. Fortunately, there's an article that came out in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences last year. There is a very large study of 340,000 Americans from all parts of the country. And they did a phone survey. And among other things, they asked one question, similar to our successful aging question. Their question was, what is your quality of well-being? And what they found was that this self-rated well-being quality was pretty high in the early 20s. You can imagine at that age when you feel on top of the world, you can do anything you want to. And then slowly as the reality hits you, you find out that's not the case. And so slowly it begins coming down. It hits a rock bottom around 50 that usually we take as a midlife crisis. When you look back and you said, gosh, I really didn't do what I set out to do. Look at my life. It is not all that great. And not only that, what do I have to look forward to? More physical illnesses, then eventually retirement and death. But for some reason, after that, people who survive that crisis, and most people do, it starts getting better. And people start feeling better about themselves. And one of the reasons is they don't compare themselves with what they were like in their 20s. In 20s, you are afraid of 80s because you look at people who are disabled and you said, I don't want to be like that. But when you're in your 80s, you don't compare yourself with 20s. You're actually happy you're not in your 20s because you don't have that peer pressure. You have actually, you feel that you have done well, that you have like done your job and raised family and whatever. And you become more accepting of yourself. So this is the paradox of aging. Physical health declines, some cognitive abilities decline, but self-rated successful aging, mental health, and even psychosocial functioning improve with age. Positive attributes like optimism, resilience, compassion, wisdom do not decline with age, but as a matter of fact, there is increase in some people. At the same time, there is heterogeneity. Not everybody does well. Some people do better than others. So that's about successful aging in general. What about the studies of physicians? As I said, the number of studies has been small, and most of these studies have limitations. Small sample sizes and the methodology is far from perfect. Nonetheless, the studies have somewhat different conclusions. So one set of studies essentially show that there is increased impairment with aging among physicians too. For example, this first study, it found that a third of the physicians who performed poorly on competency assessment had major neuropsychological impairments. And this was particularly true in older physicians. Second study found that older age and more years of physician experience were associated with longer length of stay and higher risk of patient mortality. And the third study showed that successful remediation of severely incompetent physicians was uncertain at the best. As I said, these studies have limitations. Sample sizes are small. They did not control for the types of patients that were seen by the MDs, the types of hospital they worked in. So really, we cannot take these findings at face value, although because there are some studies that show opposite kind of results. An Australian study, which looked at 158 physicians And it found that older and more experienced MDs actually had lower levels of psychological distress and burnout than younger physicians. And they felt, these older MDs, that this was because of their years of training and practice. They had been there, done that, so they were really not overwhelmed when they saw some complex issues. So the conclusion that the authors drew, I think appropriately, was that we need to find ways in which we can more efficiently pass on the lessons from the older MDs to the younger ones, which will be mutually beneficial for the younger MDs, so they will take advantage of the experience of the older ones, and the older ones feel useful. They are mentors. Another study, this was done in UK, 148 geriatric psychiatrists, and they also found lower burnout in older physicians than in younger ones. They also found that the older physicians had lower self-perceived stress. Lower burnout was associated with spending more time on research, study, and audit. So it is not that people look forward to retirement and giving everything up, and then they had happy life. The only thing I didn't like from this study was the last thing, spending less time traveling. I think I spent too much time traveling, so I hope that's not true. Another interesting study, this looked at the novel electronic health record-based tobacco treatment functionality. Most of us think that usually as people get older, and we know that that is true, our kids and grandkids are much better at handling computers and other technology than most of the older people are. And yet, this study found that among the MDs, primary care MDs, greater use of this technology was seen in staff MDs than in trainees, more in the physicians who had graduated more than 10 years earlier, people with more patient volumes, the people who were, and also those who were seeing more complicated patients. So this suggested that as MDs get more busy, they actually learn to use technology. They feel more pressure to do that than the younger ones. And they actually do that well. So question is, how can anything get better with age? When I went to medical school, I was taught that most of the growth and development of the brain occurred prenatally, and then first couple of years of life. Then there were some changes during adolescence when there is pruning of synapses, things like that. But after 20, it's pretty stable, and after 50, 55, 60, whatever age, it is all downhill course. All that you see is degeneration, deterioration, decline, dementia, depression, all of the bad things are there. And there's really nothing you can do to that. Is that true? Again, Dr. Perry will talk at detail, and so I'm not going to. But some cognitive abilities clearly decline. We have harder time remembering names, faces. Not everything declines, though. Things that we are familiar with, we continue to do well. For example, if I learned how to bike when I was 5 years old, I'm likely to continue knowing how to bike even when I develop early dementia. So the ability areas that go down, they're called fluid mechanics. Those that stay stable are called crystallized pragmatic. The provocative question is, can anything get better with aging? Dr. Montalcini, she's got the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology in the mid-1980s. She celebrated her 100th birthday a couple of years ago. And she said, my mind is sharper today than when I was 20. How is that possible? In many cultures, aging is associated with increasing wisdom. So what is wisdom? So we got into that, and we looked at all the literature, the modern Western literature, but also the ancient Eastern literature, because people often think wisdom is a cultural concept, and it varies from time to time, culture to culture. What we found was there was surprising similarity in the way wisdom was defined across times and across culture. There were clearly some differences by cultures, but the main components are same. And one of the most important components is the first one, which is sort of practical knowledge of life and social decision-making. How do we make decisions in everyday life? Another Nobel laureate, Eric Kendall, he's a neuroscientist and psychiatrist. He is on the faculty at Columbia University. He got the Nobel Prize in 2000. He said that, I think I do science better now than I did when I was younger. In science, judgment is so important, and I have a better understanding of which problems are important and which are not. And if you think about this, I think all of us here above a certain age will agree that we get better at what we do. As, for example, as physicians, if we are clinicians, then we have much better understanding of what patients are, and we can diagnose them quickly, find the better treatment, whether you are researchers, teachers, administrators, lawyers, whatever. We get better because of the experience. But are there data to support that? And actually the answer is yes. Another paper published in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences last year, this compared younger and older people in terms of their social reasoning using certain vignettes. And the conclusion was that social reasoning seemed to improve with age, in spite of the fact that some cognitive abilities like short-term memory, they worsen. This is another interesting study that just came out less than a month ago. What they did was they compared older adults with younger adults on how they make decisions. And there were two kinds of tasks. One kind of tasks were those in which you could choose based on your past experience. For example, you did something, you get a reward. You do something different, you don't get a reward. Then people are likely to choose things for which they got a reward. So those are tasks on which rewards are dependent on previous choices. Second tasks were those in which the rewards are totally independent of previous choices, and they are based more on your intuitive thinking. What the researchers found was that decisions that require experience and ability to use that experience, optimally, older adults are better decision makers. So younger people were better in terms of decisions that really didn't need experience. Intuitively, they could come to conclusions. But where you needed experience and ability to use it, older people did better. How many of you remember who is Sullenberger? I think many of you. So think about this miracle on Hudson. A couple of years ago, there was this U.S. Airways flight that took off from LaGuardia. And within minutes of taking off, apparently some flock of birds were sucked into the engine. Both the engines failed, and the pilot had just a few minutes to land. Otherwise, the plane would have crashed. The air traffic controller told him, the pilot, to go to New Jersey Airport. And he knew that if he had done that, it would have crashed because there was not enough time. So what he did, within 3 minutes, he landed on the Hudson River. So he made the decision because of his vast experience. He was 58 years old. 58 is not old, but for a pilot, it is old. It is close to what used to be the retirement for many years, which is 60. So he maneuvered a jetliner, and all the people were saved. Of course, he was invited to the White House and so on and so forth. But it's a younger pilot would never have been able to do that because they wouldn't have had the experience and the emotional regulation to do that. So he was decisive, non-impulsive, controlled his emotions, and more importantly, made the right decisions and carried it out. So the question is, that's fine psychosocially, but how does the brain, because ultimately all of these functions are dependent on the brain. So as I said, when I went to medical school, I was told that there is nothing good about aging brain. Yet one of the most important advances in neuroscience in the last 15, 20 years is what is called neuroplasticity of aging. That means the brain continues to be plastic. Plastic means moldable. It can still be molded in later life. How? There are two likely mechanisms. One is called compensation. When something fails, the rest of the body takes over. For example, if you see a person with stroke, the person is paralyzed, aphasic, mute. And 5 years later, you see that person is again walking, talking normally. What happened? Part of that brain died, clearly, because of the stroke. But the rest of the brain took over the function of that part. So that is compensation. But there is something even more exciting that is called neurogenesis, which means formation of new neurons, and synaptogenesis, which means formation of new synapses. Synapses are the connections between two neurons. The whole function of the brain is really communication, and you communicate message from one neuron to another through synapses. So, just want to show you a couple of interesting experiments. This was a study done by Dr. Rusty Gage, who is at Salk and UCSD, and this work has been replicated in various other species. In this particular study, he took some old mice. Mice usually live to the age of 3 years. So he took mice, the young mice, who were actually in this case, he only took the old mice, which are about 2 to 2.5 years old. And he randomized them into two groups. One group was put in the usual cages. Most of the time, you put four mice in a cage. They are there 24/7 for their entire lifetime in the lab. They get food and water continuously, and they don't have to do anything. The other group of mice, he put in a kind of Disneyland for the mice. That is a large open field. They could run around. There were different colors. There were roller coasters. So that lot of activity, stimulation, they had fun. After 3 months, he found that these mice in Disneyland not only had better function, but they had better structure of the brain. He found they had increased number of synapses throughout the brain, increased number of blood vessels, and also, most fascinating, increased number of neurons in some parts of the brain, not everywhere, but specifically in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus and periventricular area. So the main point is, but that's really mind-boggling to think, in mice, some kind of this physical psychological stimulation would increase the number of synapses and neurons. One might say this was true in mice, but won't occur in humans. It's hard to replicate, do a study like this in humans. It would clearly be unethical. However, there are some studies that are provocative findings. This was one study that was published in Nature, which is number one journal in science. This is the Dutch study. The investigator took some normal volunteers, young adults, and all comers. The only criteria, they did not want any professional jugglers in that. And then they divided them into two groups randomly. Both groups were told to continue their lives as usual. But the only difference was one group was told to try to juggle when they had time. And they had to juggle three balls at a time because apparently that's the minimum criterion for a juggler, that you had to juggle three balls at a time. And they did a structural MRI, the usual MRI that most of us have when we go for an MRI. In the sense, we just go into the magnet, they take the picture, and then we come out. We didn't have to do anything. It's not a functional MRI. So did the structural MRI in these people at baseline, that before this, 3 months after they juggled or did not juggle, and then again after 3 months after they stopped doing that. What they found was, in the jugglers only, there was significant increase in the gray matter in the area that is highlighted in yellow here. That's a part of the parietal lobe that is associated with what is called perceptual anticipation. You know, in juggling, the trick lies in sticking your hand to where the ball is going to land. I mean, you have to know that intuitively, and you learn that by experience. So that specific area in the parietal lobe, there was increase in gray matter that you could see on a regular MRI. I mean, obviously, they had to use some computer technology, but still. So they didn't have to open up the brains or measure cells, anything like that. Now, what does it mean, that increase in gray matter on MRI? We obviously don't know because they didn't study their brains neuropathologically. However, I don't think it means increase in number of neurons. That's unlikely. More likely, it's increase in number of synapses, blood vessels, whatever it is, the fact that there could be such a striking structural change with something as silly as juggling for 3 months is really remarkable. Even more remarkable is this study by same investigators. They looked at medical students who were preparing for their board examination. And they did a structural MRI. There, I think, there are about 38 medical students. They did a structural MRI 3 months before their boards. With most medical students, they study in the last few months. You know, that's right. So, and then they did repeated the MRI a day or two after their exam. They found that there was significant increase in the gray matter in specific parts of the parietal lobe as well as hippocampus. So the upper two section, upper four, actually those brains, they show increase in gray matter in the parietal lobes. And they repeated the MRI again after 3 months after the board. And essentially they found there's significant increase in the gray matter 3 months parietal lobe, and it stayed same for three more months. The lower one, they found increase in gray matter in hippocampus at 3 months, but it seemed to increase further over the next 3 months. So what it meant, what it suggested, is that focused learning can increase the gray matter in specific parts of the brain, and some of those changes persist for a long time. So here we are not even talking about physical activity like juggling. We are talking about purely cognitive activity, learning, that can produce structural changes in the brain. Now, that's in normal people. Even in people with schizophrenia, psychotherapy can produce structural changes. This was a study published last year from Harvard-Pittsburgh group. So these patients had cognitive enhancement therapy, which is a form of intensive psychotherapy given to people with schizophrenia. So, and some people received supportive therapy. So these are the scans of the people who received supportive therapy. Essentially, you don't see any change in the structural MRI before and after. These are the scans of the people who received that psychotherapy. You see significant increase in the gray matter in several parts of the brain. So even psychotherapy, even in people with schizophrenia, can produce structural changes. This is a study done at University of California, San Francisco. They found that one form of psychotherapy called cognitive remediation increase what is called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It's a chemical that is associated with increased activity and function of the neurons. So it's almost like this kind of work is like putting your brain on a treadmill. Normally, we stand and run on the treadmill, and that strengthens our leg muscles and other muscles. So cognitive activities are like putting your brain on the treadmill, which would improve the brain, not only function, but structure. So that, as I said, is one of the most exciting findings of science. But that was in general. So again, this conference is on physicians. So are there examples of successful aging among physicians? There are some unique issues about older MDs. The strengths are, of course, that physicians are obviously very highly educated. They are also, you know, higher socioeconomic status than the general population. A lot of respect for physicians. In general, still physicians continue to be one of the most respected groups in the society. And to be a physician, you have to have certain traits. You have to have perseverance, some obsessionality, some other diplomatic and other skills. But there are also liabilities. Being a physician is stressful. You work and work and work. Other people expect you to be perfect all the time, because if you make a mistake and if it hurts somebody, you are held liable to that. There are limited outside interests, partly because there are limited time for outside interests. Personal life becomes professional life. There is often very little personal life outside your job. Most physicians are so busy working that they never plan their retirement except for financial things. And retirement has adverse effects in anybody. Financial, obviously. Reduced self-esteem, especially for physicians, because self-esteem depends on how you are valued, and when you don't do that job anymore, self-esteem goes down. And then you have a lot of time available on your hand, and you don't know what to do with it because you never had to deal with that issue for decades. Of course, there are variations by culture, variations by gender and specialty you're in. I'm just going to show you a few examples of people who have, physicians who have been aging successfully in different ways. Dr. Beck is an example of successful aging through continued research. He is a professor emeritus of psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. He's the father of cognitive behavior therapy. He got the Lasker Award a couple of years ago. The Lasker is thought to be the American Nobel. He continues to write. Just last year, he got a new NIH grant. And he's 90 years old now. And he wrote a book with his daughter, Judith Beck, that was published earlier this year. And next year, in May 2012, he's going to be one of the featured speakers at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. So that's an example of somebody who continues to do what he did most of his life, which is research. Michael DeBakey, I think many of you may remember him, a famous heart surgeon, example of successful aging through continued clinical work. Pioneering heart surgeon, educator, innovator, he was called the greatest surgeon of the 20th century. He performed more than 60,000 heart surgeries, and he finally stopped surgery at the age of 90. Obviously, he was not doing major surgery in his 80s or even late 70s. He was doing, but still, he went to the operating room and he did some things. And even after 90, he continued to see patients. He stopped surgery, but he would often consult on patients for an hour or two. His secret, he said his secret of successful aging was constant intellectual challenge, good salads, and 4 to 5 hours of sleep at night. He didn't eat anything other than the salad, apparently. I don't know how anybody can do that. another example, Shigeyaki Hinohara, example of successful aging through community service. He turned 100 earlier this year. He chaired the board of trustees of an international hospital in Tokyo, also a nursing school, published several books since his 75th birthday, including one titled Living Long, Living Good. It has sold more than 1 million copies. He founded the New Elderly Movement. He works 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and his advice is contribute to the society. So there are clearly examples of physicians who have managed to do well in old age. And this is even a more striking example. William Carlos Williams, this was his self-portrait in oil at age 30. This is Dr. Williams at age 65. He was a physician, he was a pediatrician, and he was also a poet. He was in private practice. He had to work because to make money. I mean, his family was not particularly rich. He loved to write poetry, but he didn't have time to write poetry because he was so busy. On top of that, he suffered from major depressive episodes beginning at age 16. In his 50s, he had an MI. In his 60s, he had 2 strokes. He developed post-stroke depression. He got so disabled after his 2nd stroke that he could not use his arms, and his wife then would type the poems that he would dictate. He wrote better. So one thing that happened with his after his MI especially, that he could not practice anymore. And he then said that, okay, if I can't practice, actually I will do more of the thing that I really wanted to do all my life, which is writing poetry. So he started spending more time on writing poetry, and he wrote better poetry. He called it more mature poetry. And he got Pulitzer Prize, National Book Award, Golden Medal for Poetry for the epics that he wrote after the age of 50. So my last 2 slides. So general strategies for successful aging that could apply to anybody. The first is my least favorite one, calorie restriction. But unfortunately, that's the one for which there is strongest evidence base in every single species. The second most evidence-based strategy is physical exercise. And physical exercise doesn't mean being on treadmill 4 hours a day, increasing your physical activity. Optimizing stress, not eliminating stress, not that it would be possible, but because some stress is thought to be useful. There is something called stress inoculation. Some stress prepares you to face more later on. There are some foods called superfoods, which are rich in antioxidants, like broccoli, cauliflower. My favorite is curcumin, which is an Indian spice. Again, there are epidemiologic data on these and some animal data. This is not enough, though. These are all physical strategies. Equally important are the psychosocial strategies. Psychosocially stimulating environment. That experiment with mice I told you. I mean, all that the mice had was this stimulating environment and physical activity. Positive attitude. Several studies done at Yale have shown that people who have positive attitude on an average live 8 years longer than people with negative attitude after controlling for the usual factors. Another Dutch study found that people who are more optimistic have 50% lower mortality from cardiovascular disease than people who are more pessimistic, again, after controlling for the usual factors. Learning new skills, and it is never too early nor too late to start. This is my last slide. The specific strategies for MDs. I think in MDs, in terms of retirement specifically, that the strategies need to be personalized, obviously, no one size fits all. And I gave you examples of successful aging through, or successful retirement, if you will, in some ways, continuing research, continuing clinical work, community service, renewing hobbies, great opportunity for mentoring trainees and young colleagues. It's like a football player, after a certain age, he can't play, but then he can become a coach. Learning new techniques. One can learn new things in later life. The trick lies in finding something that is challenging, but not too stressful. It got to be challenging, because if it is same, it is the same boring thing, it really doesn't help your brain. So it needs to be challenging, but not so challenging that it is stressful and you will fail, then it doesn't help either. Lecturing and writing for the lay public, because we have accumulated so much knowledge in our lifetime, I think we can do that, which we couldn't do during most of our years as physicians. So what is wisdom? I think wisdom is that serenity prayer, serenity to accept the things one cannot change. So there are things which will happen with aging, such as physical aging, that usually not totally under our control. It is partly, but not totally. Courage to change the things one can, not take a defeatist attitude that I'm getting old, so I can't do anything, and wisdom to know the difference. Let's stop here, and thank you. Hey, Laura.
Very nice talk, Dilip. You talked about stress inoculation and the need to optimize stress and have, but also to have, as well as the difficulty that many physicians have when they stop working, because work has been such a part of their life. There's such an emphasis now on physician wellness, and reduced. Now there's also been even more reduced work hours for residents. I just wondered if you can sort of predict what you think might happen as a generation that has been working less hard, perhaps, begins to age. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Discuss.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a good question. And we'll only see with the data. I actually feel much more optimistic about that. I mean, in general, people, generation after generation, people have said that the younger generations are lazy, and they didn't, starting from the time of Socrates, people have said that really they don't work as hard as we used to. I know even in the medical school, there are some places there is a new pathway that started, I think, what, 15, 20 years ago. And the old timers complained that this is not the way to learn. I mean, we learned this way. We spent 23 hours working continuously. My feeling is that times change, and the younger generation is much more savvy at the technology and a bunch of other things, and maybe the things which we did are not necessary for this. And also, so I feel that I'm not really concerned about that. I think they will do fine, and we should take pride in that, that they will do fine, because we raise them, and we are mentoring them.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Dr. Jesty.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.